nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Although my bike is closer to my office than even those cars. So. Yeah, I love. My bike is literally 10 feet from my office. It gets, and it gets excellent gas mileage.
Yeah.
No. No, the closest I got to joining that revolution was a couple years ago. I bought a internally geared hub bike, you know, like a 3-speed. This it has, I think it's got 7. So yeah, it's the Nexus, and it's just sufficient to. I live up the hill, up the Grant Street Hill, and. The dynamic range, I'd like to, I think it's 15% gear ratio change between each gear, and I'd like to have more like 20, 25 maybe. Because the top end and the bottom end, I mean, I'm pedaling like crazy when I'm coming down the hill, and when I'm going up the hill, it's not, gear ratio is not quite low enough. So, the fixie would be awful. Going up that hill, I mean, coming down, and then going up would be awful too. So, yeah. Yeah, I was in Hodson's complaining about the gear ratio to the guy who sold me the bike, and he said he rides around campus, rides up that hill, on, rides up and down it on a fixie. So,
getting used to it, it's not too bad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you got to have a brake. Yeah. If you have a fixie without a brake, I think you're just asking for trouble. Yeah. You'll put at least a front caliper brake on it. Let's see. We were doing notepad or journal. Let's see. All right. So, I suppose it's time to get started. Where we left off last time was we were talking about this issue of Navier's slip flow boundary condition and how we almost never encounter that in fluid mechanics, either at the undergrad level or even at the grad level. So we were doing a mathematical solution of the Navier-Stokes equation for this geometry, which is configuration, which is called Couette flow. And since it was two class periods ago, I'll remind you a little bit about the configuration. Right? Fixed bottom plate, sliding upper plate, and this is this is a generalization. Actually, this is a specific case of the general case where the two plates are moving relative to each other. And relative to each other, you know, could mean like here we have linear translation, could be rotation as well. And that certainly changes things, but the basic case that and that still has all the physics that we're or we will be interested in is this what's called plane Couette flow. So, and the fixing the bottom plate, that doesn't really matter. You know, we could equally think about the bottom plate moving to the left at speed u and the top plate moving to the right at speed u. I guess from your point of view, that's the opposite direction. Anyhow. So we have these two planes. The top plane moves in its own plane parallel to the bottom plane. They're separated by a distance h, and u is constant. And so we started talking about the symmetries. Okay, so the symmetries, if you were in 509, symmetries are everything. Symmetries allow you to simplify your governing equations. From, you know, something that's horrendous, like that, from something that's horrendous, if we take away all the black crossouts, you count up the number of terms there, there's 4 on the left-hand side and 4 on the right-hand side, times 3, there's 12 terms in these three equations and another 3 in the conservation of mass equation. That makes life hard. So, we definitely want to simplify that. And symmetries are the way that you can simplify things. So you recognize, then this is the way the argument goes. If you're looking at this, you as the experimenter or as the solver, you're looking at this, and if you can move your point of view without changing the picture, then, let's say if you can move your point of view and you wouldn't notice, or you could tell somebody, you're working with somebody, you tell your partner to close his or her eyes, and you move this thing to the left or the right, and then they open their eyes, if they can't tell that it's been moved, that's an axis of symmetry. All right, so we talked about this thing being infinitely long in the left and the right directions. So if you're looking at this and you close your eyes and then I take the thing and I move it to the left or the right, you have no idea it's been moved. Okay, so that means you have translational symmetry. And translational symmetry, the mathematical interpretation of translational symmetry, is that gradients in that direction in which you're translating things are equal to zero. So we have that in the x direction, we have that in the z direction, right? If I this is a cross section through this plane. So if I moved into or out of the plane, again, it would look exactly the same. So we have a z directional symmetry as well. How about y? And if you close your eyes and I move this thing up or down, you'll see that, right? I mean, it was initially at this height. If I move it down, you see, okay, the bottom plate has moved some distance. So we definitely don't have translational symmetry in the Z direction. If you're a computational person or a physicist, I have a physics undergrad degree and we do this stuff all day in physics. There's other symmetries that we could concern ourselves with, so reflectional symmetries and rotational symmetries and so forth. In this problem, these are the two symmetries, the only two that we need to worry about. And then steady state. That's the same. In fact, steady state is basically translational symmetry along the time axis. Okay, so that means if I do the same thing, I put you in front of this, and I let time elapse. Tell you to close your eyes, let time elapse, you open your eyes. The picture is exactly the same. Right? The top plate has moved to the right. If these are finite plates, and you could see the ends of the plate, you would see that the top plate had moved to the right, and they were no longer overlapped the same way that they were. But we're imagining that this gap is really small compared to L and W. So you don't really see the ends. So if you're just looking at this middle area away from the ends, and I let time elapse, this plate moves to the right, but we don't see that. We don't notice it. Okay, so that means you have translational symmetry with respect to the time axis. And we have a special word for that, which is steady state. All right, so any questions about that? Those are important observations to simplify this problem. Okay, so where we finished up last time was, well, we just went through our conservation of mass equation and our Navier-Stokes equation and crossed out all the stuff, all those partial derivatives along the axes that had symmetry. So partial with respect to x and partial with respect to z. So that leaves us with the only thing that survives from conservation of mass is that the partial of v with respect to y is equal to zero. I'd like to have these all on one page, but they don't quite fit. So let's look at Navier-Stokes. Went through and crossed out a whole bunch of stuff, right? So all derivatives with respect to t, x, and z go to zero. So we cross out all of those. And you're not left with a whole lot. So essentially, derivatives with respect to t, x, and z go to zero. That means all you're left with is derivatives with respect to y. All right, so we have derivatives with respect to y just occur in one place, in one column here. And we have a derivative with respect to y there. And then in the viscous terms, the derivatives with respect to y are again sort of in one column. All right. So now we have a simplified version of the Navier-Stokes equations. Now we can attempt to solve this. So, 509 people know where to start, and the rest of you could probably, if I ask you where to start, you'd have to say here, right? I mean, even if you haven't solved this problem before, this equation is the simplest equation. So, partial derivative of v with respect to y is equal to zero. We already know the partial derivative with respect to x, z, and t, those partials are equal to zero. So this says all of the partial derivatives, x, y, z, and t, all of those partial derivatives are equal to zero. So we could integrate this, but we don't have to. And if I know all the derivatives are equal to zero, what does that tell me about that quantity v? Yeah, if the derivatives are equal to zero, it's unchanging. All right, so that tells me that v has to be equal to a constant. V is equal to some constant, let's call it C1, just because C looks like a constant. All right, so how do I find a value for C1? This is a general solution. So when you're doing differential equation solutions, you'd call this the general solution. So we know that V is equal to a constant, but we don't know what that constant is. So we need the particular solution. What's the particular value of C1 for this case? So how do you find, once you've solved the differential equation, how do you find the particular solution? Boundary conditions, right? So we haven't said anything about boundary condition. I mean, I guess I did say a little bit, right? We want to look at the slip flow boundary condition. So, you know, obviously, you know, we're heading that direction. But this V, remember, did I have the interpretation here? So I think that was on the next page. This is my standard notation for velocity fields. So capital V, this is the velocity field. This is the vector velocity field. So I got a bar over it. The bar means vector. So the vector velocity field is, this is the x component of the velocity, the y component of the velocity, and the z component of the velocity. Actually, maybe it's better to say the I, j, and k components of the velocity. So this is the component of the velocity that's directed in the vertical direction according to my coordinate system. In my picture. So what's going to be the appropriate boundary condition? What are the in the vertical directions? What would be the appropriate boundary condition on that V component? Yeah, I'm not trying to trick you. This one's easy. All right, so I think Drew, Andre, Taylor, Dan, I think you guys have seen this before. So what's the right boundary condition? V is this way.
No penetration?
Yeah, right. The flow can't go through the wall. So I called these things planes. And maybe if I was more explicit and I said, what would I say? A solid plane. Then you would say, okay, these are solid. I know if they were porous or something, there could be flow through the plane. And that would be sort of a Darcy's Law type problem. But they're not. They're solid. So that means the flow can't go through them. So that boundary condition. So the boundary conditions. So let's put them down as in the order in which we write them. So the boundary condition on V, that the little v, at at y is equal to 0 and y is equal to h, the flow, the velocity has to be equal to 0. So v of 0 equals v of h equals 0. That's the appropriate boundary condition. And we come here, and this says that our velocity is equal to some constant. And because the derivatives of with respect to x, y, z, and t have all disappeared, this is a constant, means it's not a function of y. Right? Normally, this would be a function of something. Well, it's not a function of anything because all the partial derivatives are equal to zero. So v is a constant. So when I apply the boundary condition, I can choose anywhere. I could choose y equals 0. I could choose y equals h. I could choose y equals infinity. But I don't know what the flow should be there. I know what the flow should be at 0 and h. So if I pick, you know, arbitrarily 0, then I know that c1 has to be equal to 0. That's the particular solution. So let's see, all right, so now I've come up with another condition, and that condition is that little v is equal to 0. And so I can cross off a bunch of v's everywhere I see a v. That's equal to 0. That term's twice equal to 0. So all of those go away. And there's a v there. That goes to 0. All right. So let's look at what we have left. Okay, I got it. So what we have left is, if we look at the I component, I have the second derivative of u with respect to y is equal to 0. And in the j equation, I have just this term. Partial derivative of the pressure with respect to y is equal to 0. And in the z equation, I have this term. That's the only thing. So there's three terms left. I started out with, 4, 8, 12. Started out with 12 here, I'm left with 3. And they're not even mixed, right? There's one in each line. So these are really easy differential equations to solve. All right, now, before we do that, I want to make an observation. And that observation is, now remember, Dan was uncomfortable with the Reynolds number. I'm going to pick on you, Dan. So Dan was uncomfortable with the Reynolds number being only an order of magnitude less than 1. So the numbers that I ran a couple class periods ago, I said Reynolds number is, for that particular parameters that I chose, was 0.1. And then I said, okay, if the equations are non-dimensionalized, then and the Reynolds number on the left-hand side is 0.1, the left-hand side's small compared to the right-hand side. And we threw that away. Actually, we were looking at this equation up here. We're looking at that equation, and we had, this is the dimensional form of the equation. You can see there's a mu there and a rho there. So this is the dimensional form of the Navier-Stokes equation. But if we put all those primes back in and collect all the parameters, we have a Reynolds number multiplying this term. And that Reynolds number was the thing that was small, right? So if the Reynolds number is small, then we lose the left-hand side of this equation. And we're left with the right. And we called the right-hand side the Stokes equation. So that is... So the Stokes equation is just these two terms, these two linear terms. Really nice equation to work with. So this is the troublesome, actually right here, this is the troublesome term in Navier-Stokes. So this is a really nice equation to work with. So Stokes, let's see. So Reynolds number, much, much less than 1, implies Stokes equation, which means low Reynolds number flow. Strange. Now, we haven't made any such assumption, right? In our derivation so far, we haven't made any such assumption. I started out with the general form of the Navier-Stokes equation. Haven't said anything about how fast, how big U is, or what the separation H is. Haven't said anything about that. I don't know how big any of that stuff is. Nonetheless, the left-hand side of the Navier-Stokes equation goes away, right? Everything cancels out to zero for a couple of different reasons. You know, for largely for symmetries. All the black lines are symmetries. Those terms go to zero because of symmetry. And the blue is because of the impenetrability of the two planes. Actually, either plane. I could have a sponge for a top plane. If I have the bottom plane as non-porous, I still won't get any flow because I have that one non-penetration boundary condition. All right, so, but the end result is the whole left-hand side goes to zero. So, that is the same result that we got for saying the Reynolds number is small. We get for what are called parallel flows. So, parallel flows with non-porous boundaries say same as Stokes flows. So parallel flows, parallel flows doesn't tell me anything about how anything is moving, how fast it's moving, in what direction it's moving. It just tells me the flow is, the geometry inside of which the flow is happening is, has the symmetry that it's, let's say, infinitely long and it doesn't change in the directions where you have symmetry. Okay, so that means things like pressure-driven flow in a long round tube has the same effect. So you have, that's a parallel flow as well. Pressure-driven flow in a long slot. If I fix the top plate and the bottom plate, and then I take a pump, so I still have these infinite planes, but then I take a pump and I pump the flow through this geometry. We argued the symmetries. Remember, we argued the symmetries before we talked at all about, you know, the velocity field. Okay, so, the parallel flow comes from the fact that comes from the symmetries. And so, if we have parallel flows and there's no flow, let's say through the boundaries, we get the same governing equation as Stokes flow. So, there's something wrong with that statement, or at least it's not complete. So, what's the problem with that Think about flow through a long tube. When would the flow through a long tube not be the same as a Stokes flow? What's that? If 509 people can answer this one. When would it not be the same? Think about what happens if you crank the flow rate up. No? Nobody? Well, yeah, turbulence. Yeah. So if you move the top plate fast enough in the situation we're looking at, you'll get turbulent flow. If you drive the speed of the pump fast enough, in the case of, you know, if you're thinking about pump driving flow through a long tube, eventually you'll get to turbulence, right? And turbulence involves, for those of you who haven't had a grad or don't remember their undergrad fluid mechanics, right? Turbulence involves the Reynolds number, just like the Stokes flow does. So when the Reynolds number gets to be big, and all that the analysis says is when the Reynolds number is much greater than 1, turbulence is important. There's no fixed number. There's no criterion. Actually, I guess this is it. Reynolds number much greater than 1. So how much greater than 1? Well, okay, that's actually there's no precise value. But you might remember 2000, 2300. That's kind of the threshold that we use in mechanical engineering. We remember this number 2300. And a lot of undergrads and even some grad students get this stuck in their head as a rigid boundary, as a precise boundary. 2299 is laminar flow. 2301 is turbulent flow. That's not at all how it works. I can get a turbulent flow at a Reynolds number of a couple hundred. That's possible. And I can get a laminar flow others have, at 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6, so 100,000 or a million. Nice smooth tube, really contoured entrance into the tube, a pump with no fluctuations. You know, spend some money, you can get laminar flows at really high Reynolds numbers. So this is a rule of thumb. And when you're looking at bigger micro devices, you know, sort of 100 micron length scales, and something that's moving fast, like not even that fast, but something like meters a second. Meters a second is inkjet printheads dispense drops at meters per second. So these sort of you do end up having to worry about turbulence in micro devices, let's say in a small class of micro devices. So most micro devices, you're going to be in the Stokes flow regime, but in some micro devices, you can see turbulent flow. And certainly, when the Reynolds number gets to be bigger than 1, say maybe not much, much bigger than 1, but when it gets to be bigger than 1, let's do that. So greater than and a squiggle. So approximately bigger than 1. We start to see what are called inertial effects. And inertial effects are things like vortices. All right. That's the Italian spelling of vortices. Let's see if I can render this in a form that is understandable. If I flow around a corner, and if my computer helps me out. Let's see. So we get, here's flow around a corner. Those are streamlines. And we have two regions of flow separation in this sort of a geometry. We have two regions of flow separation in this geometry. At the outside corner, there's a little vortex that stands there. And just past this, the inside corner, there's a little vortex that stands there. These guys, you first observe these when the Reynolds number's on the order of a single digits. So maybe 8, Reynolds number 8. Certainly by the time you get to 10, you start to see this separation like this. Reynolds number's less than 1, what happens is the streamlines are everywhere parallel to the wall. So the streamline that comes along, there would be the left wall would be a streamline, and the flow would go up and turn right, you know, sharp, hard right. And the same thing for the inside wall. For Reynolds number less than 1, for Stokes flow, there's no inertia. What causes this separation is you're going around a corner, and the flow, the individual fluid particles, as you go around a corner in your car, what happens? Right? You turn the wheel to the right, you feel an acceleration to the left. That's centripetal acceleration. You get pushed outwards. Same thing happens to the fluid particles that are traveling along the streamlines. They get pushed outwards. And so we get these two regions of flow separation when that force, that centripetal acceleration, we'll say you've got to multiply it times density to get a force, but when that force is large enough that viscosity can't kill it. And that happens, right? Reynolds number is the ratio of inertial forces to viscous forces. So when this Reynolds number is bigger than 1, we get this separation. And these sort of vortices, then you would still call this a laminar flow, but there are inertial effects. It's no longer a parallel flow. You have these separation effects. These are inertial effects. And these are definitely seen, you know, in micro devices. As Dan noted, the Reynolds number. If I pump my flow just a little bit faster, let's say an order of magnitude faster, in the numbers that I used two lectures ago, I would have Reynolds number about the size of 1, and I would see this in my device. So the bottom line is you can't always use Stokes flows. You can't always use Stokes equation in a small device because regardless of how small the device is, there's always a speed that you can increase to where you'll get a Reynolds number on the order of 1. Remember rho VD over mu is the Reynolds number, so you have V and D in the top, in the denominator. So if D is fixed, there's always some V that will push the Reynolds number high enough that you'll see first inertial effects and then turbulence. All right. So everybody clear with that? Are we ready to move on? This was sort of an aside because we're still trying to solve this problem of what happens in our plane Couette flow. All right. So we have to solve these three equations. And they're really not much of an equation. Each of them is not much of an equation to solve. So second order derivative of u is equal to zero. Second order derivative of w is equal to zero. And so, and we know that all of the variables that are left are not functions of x, z, or t. They're only functions of y. That's the symmetry. Okay, so they're only functions of y, which means I can change these partials to full to d's, and I can change the partials to d's to full derivatives. So I have the second order derivative of w with respect to y is equal to zero. So what's the solution? What's w look like? Second order derivative is equal to zero. Yeah. Integrate once, I get a constant. Integrate twice, I get a line. All right, so this guy's a line. These two are lines, and that one is a constant. All right. Okay, so, and then that'll bring up the discussion then. Once we have lines and constants, we need to apply boundary conditions. So we need to talk about, need to put the note down some other boundary conditions here. So we have two boundaries, right? Boundary at 0 and a boundary at h. And u is the most important term. So we have these two boundaries. Let's do this. Let's first of all, just so that the people who weren't in 509, let's do the standard assumption, which is to assume no slip. All right, and then we'll see what answer we get. Then we'll assume a slip flow boundary condition, and we'll see what changes. All right, so no slip. So what we're assuming now is we're looking at u. U is the horizontal, right? U is the component in the I direction or the X direction. All right, so there's the answer. I gave you the answer. The answer is u looks like this. So if we assume no slip, u of 0 is equal to 0, and u of h is equal to big U, right? And w we need to say something about that. So w of 0, there's no motion in the w in the x or sorry in the z direction, the z or the k direction. There's no motion. So I'm not moving the bottom plate, so that boundary condition, w of 0, is exactly the same as it would be for u. And the top plate is moving, but only in the I or the x direction. So the velocity of the top plate in the z direction is equal to 0. So those are my parallel, a tangential. These are, so to separate these boundary conditions, and you know, this one is the normal boundary condition perpendicular to the boundary, and these two are the boundary condition parallel to the boundary, tangent to the boundary. This one is, you know, is by definition has to be true. I say that the planes are non-porous. The flow through the planes by definition has to be equal to zero. This is fundamental. This has to be true. These two, the U and the W boundary conditions, those are assumptions. Those are models. And the model is the no-slip model that the flow sticks to the boundary. And remember, I said there was this huge debate about whether that was the right model. So these are assumptions. They're pretty decent assumptions at large length scales, but they're just assumptions. They're not. Maybe constitutive relationships would be another way to say that. We assume that the flow is equal to zero and y, or zero and u. All right. So, questions on that? No slip condition. So we'll start with that. Let's come here. So, and we should probably say something about the pressure. And the pressure boundary condition, we can just pick a point. We can say, all right, here, some arbitrary point. Let's call it P0. Just some point. And I could pick anywhere, as long as it's between the plates somewhere. And you know that because the there's only one... because when we integrate partial of P with respect to Y is equal to 0, well, we're going to get the same... All of a sudden, my... I can't... Oh, there we go. I think my computer went to sleep for a second. So, just like with the V component of the velocity, we're going to see that it doesn't matter where I apply that boundary condition, right? So, derivatives, symmetries, derivatives of X with respect to X, Z, and T are equal to 0. This says the derivative with respect to Y is equal to 0. So, P is a constant. So, somewhere in the domain, P is equal to P0. In fact, let's just be... we can be really terse here, and we'll just say P equals P0. Everybody okay with that? So, P has to be equal to a constant. Doesn't matter where we apply that constant, but it's equal to P0. That leaves us with the other two equations to deal with. Oh, for heaven's sake. So, the x equation was partial with partial of u with respect to y squared is equal to 0. And actually, since we know that it's not a function of x, z, or t either, we know we can change those partials to full derivatives. So then I integrate this, and as Jonathan said, that is a line. So I end up with u of y is equal to, let's call it c2 times y plus c3. End up with the same equation for w. W is equal to c4 times y plus c5. So now I have my boundary conditions. So w of 0 is equal to 0. W of h is equal to 0. All right, so I write my two equations and two unknowns. And I'll leave this for you guys to demonstrate. The particular solution is w of y is equal to 0. So w for all y is equal to 0. That might not be immediately clear, but it's got to be. All right. And then we have up here, u of 0 is equal to 0. U of h is equal to big U. So now we have to be a little more careful because it's not the trivial solution. So if I come down here and I have big U is equal to C2 times H plus C3 and 0 is equal to C2 times 0 plus C3. All right, so C3 is equal to 0. And C2 is equal to U over H. So then put that all back together, and I have U of Y is equal to C2 times Y. So U times Y over H, and C3 is equal to 0. So that's a line, but it's even a special case of a line, right? A line has two parameters. This has one parameter. This is constant. This is proportionality. This is, so I think a lot of times people get a little confused and say, this is a linear relationship. It's true it's a linear relationship, but it's a more special relationship than that. It's a relation, it's a proportional relationship. So it's a proportional relationship that looks like exactly like I drew there. All right, so we should always, when we come up with a solution, we should always check it and make sure that it looks right. So at y equals 0, this is equal to 0. At y equals h, it's equal to big U. Right? That's the only check you have to do here. So you can say BC's checkout. Okay. That's the no-slip case. Anybody have any questions? Well, now we change our boundary conditions. Consider Navier's slip boundary condition now. All right, Navier's boundary condition, to remind you. So Navier's boundary condition, I wrote it like this. So delta U is equal to, let me make sure I get this signs right here. All right. Does anybody remember the, I had U fluid minus U wall, or U wall minus U fluid. U fluid minus U wall. So U fluid minus U wall. And that is equal to some fudge factor, LS, times the partial derivative of U with respect to Y. As Y approaches the wall. All right, so I wrote this. This was in the notes. It's not complete. For purposes of discussion, it was a good place to start, but it's not complete. This is only true for Cartesian coordinates, and only true when Y is the wall normal direction. Okay, so a more precise way to write this would be to create a normal vector n and let that normal vector approach the wall, or let that normal coordinate n go to the wall. Now, the reason why I have to talk about writing this boundary condition appropriately is that we have two walls here, right? The fixed bottom wall, the moving top wall. And so we have to write Navier's boundary condition on both surfaces. And on the bottom surface, we had a coordinate system that started with y equals 0 at the bottom wall. And if we don't manage the signs correctly, what we'll get is we'll find out that the flow actually accelerates. It goes faster along the top wall. If I don't put the right signs here, I'm going to get the wrong direction of the slip. And we're going to see, let's say, slip that moves the flow faster, and that can't be. So let me illustrate a little more what I'm talking about. So on the bottom wall, our normal direction, a normal pointing into the flow is in that direction. So let's call that NB for bottom. On the top wall, our normal vector, our normal direction pointing into the flow is going to point in the negative y direction. Right? So NB, say that's the, with the hat over it, it's the direction. Without the hat over it, it's the coordinate, just like y would be. So NB would be equal to, not I, it's J. So NB is equal to J. NT is equal to minus J. All right, so, and there's our minus sign. So we're going to need a minus sign that comes into this coordinate, this derivative. All right, so then as we're progressing on writing this boundary condition, let's do the bottom boundary condition. So we have delta U is equal to U fluid minus U wall. U wall is equal to zero. And we have that's equal to LS times du dy for y going to zero, right? That's the wall location there. That's easy enough. On the top wall, same boundary condition, delta U is equal to U fluid. U fluid's the unknown. U fluid minus U wall. So U wall on the top wall is big U. And then we have LS and a minus du dy as y goes to h. All right, does that seem reasonable? All right. So the only thing that we, and actually I should say one thing that I'm assuming here. So remember we talked about LS, you know, in the case of gases, LS is the mean free path, and then this little arrangement of tangential momentum accommodation coefficients. In the case of liquid flows, what LS is less precisely known and usually requires experiments, but is certainly related to the chemical species that are involved. So when you're talking about, it's related to the chemical species of the fluid, you know, let's say it's water, and of the wall, could be glass, could be silicon, could be some plastic, whatever. And also the relative roughness of the wall. So this LS is a complicated quantity. And here, by using the same LS, I'm going to have the same fluid in contact with both walls, but both walls needn't be the same material, right? One could be glass and one could be aluminum. And then I might have LS top, LS bottom, and LS top. These could be two different numbers. So that's what I'm already making a simplifying assumption here, that LS is the same in both cases. Unfortunately, I think we're going to have to hold it here until next time. But basically, we're pretty close to the solution now. So we have, you see, I have U over here, and I know what U looks like because we just solved for that. So I'm going to plug in the velocity profile, the line. I'm going to plug in that line here, and then I have the derivatives of U there. So the first order derivative, so that's going to be, I'm going to plug in the right constant. I think I called it C2. So this was C2y plus C3. And then this one's just going to be C2. I'm going to have two equations and two unknowns, and I can solve for C2 and C3. So we'll do that next time, and then we'll also take a look at shear stress, and we'll integrate, get volume flow rate, and then we'll be done with this case. All right, that's it for today. See you Monday.